Well, hello everyone, and welcome to another edition of The Deepest Lore. We are still in our reviewing Adam Curtis series or season. This is the 13th episode of that. It's a kind of a series within a show, if that makes any sense. Deepest Lore has been given over to this for however long it will last. It requires 7,800 viewers per episode in order to have to continue. If it ever dips below that in the week, in the calendar week between the two shows, it will be discontinued and Deepest Lore will return to regular programming. Okay, so today we're going to be talking about how Margaret Thatcher used my favorite person, of course, Winston Churchill, probably the biggest traitor in Britain's history. Worst leader in Britain's history, Winston Churchill. Absolute scumbag, as we have discussed on previous episodes of this show. If you haven't seen those, I recommend you go back and watch them. We're going to be looking at how Margaret Thatcher kind of used the memory of Churchill and his legacy to bolster her own kind of political perception in the 80s. Now, just before we get going, I will remind everybody that you should buy courses at the Academic Agency. Let me just play a little trailer. Let's go with... Sorry, I'm trying to find them. Let's go with this one.
Foundations of Politics, only £350. Buy it now. See the world as it is and not how it ought to be. History is the graveyard of aristocracy. Who says organization? Says oligarchy. Who decides? Who interprets? The extremes of individualism and socialism meet. That was their predestined course. Foundations of Politics. Only £350. Buy it now.
Great. I will also remind people to join the channel. I don't really plug that enough, but I reorganized Unpopular Opinions yesterday. So that it's all in seasons, so it's much easier to navigate. Cigar Stream and this stream are still all in one playlist, but Unpopular Opinions is in different seasons. And just to explain, this show, Deepest Lore, is always free, doesn't go behind the paywall. Unpopular Opinions goes behind the paywall after 2 weeks, as does Cigar Stream. If you get in the cheapest option, which is like £2 a month or something, you get all of the back catalogue of Unpopular Opinions, which increasingly becomes not only a trip down memory lane, but a historical archive of important events that we've covered since the show has been on air. I think Unpopular Opinions started in 2017. So, you know, £2 a month or whatever it is for that is a bargain, really. Cigar Stream is on the second tier up, which is about a fiver a month, I think. Price of a cup of coffee and a biscuit, something like that. And that gets you all of the Cigar Streams. And then the top two tiers really are for, you do get a lot more content on those top two tiers. Old videos, some embarrassing old videos even. you know, things that are a bit spicy and things like that. Things that I don't want people to see for one reason or another. They're all basically everything that's ever been on this channel is on the top tier. The next tier down, like there's four. The top one's got everything. The one just below it has got kind of old streams, like debates I used to do with Ray Murasami. It's got, I don't know, there's a mix. But I would say the most, you know, the one a lot of people go for is the one where you get Cigar Stream and Unpopular Opinions, which is literally hundreds, thousands of hours of content, better than Netflix. Anyway, I'll try to mention that more because people don't really understand that. The shows go behind the paywall. I'm sick of people asking me. All right. So let us start then. We're finishing off with The Living Dead. Before we get going, I'll just mention that part two last week was just insane. It was so dark. And this was about the CIA memory wiping techniques in the 50s. And I mean, Curtis slipped into overdrive last week. I mean, it was a step up in terms of, you know, red pilling and in terms of just, you know, the content went pretty hard last week. I'm not expecting this one to be at that level, but I'm kind of very interested in this topic due to my hatred of the Tory party and especially of Winston Churchill. I also think Thatcher gets too much of an easy ride from a lot of people. Basically, she was bad for the country. This is explained in a book by John Gray called False Dawn, which I did a dedicated stream to before, where basically Thatcher, you know, I made a tweet just before I came on air. I said, Winston Churchill dug the grave. Wilson and Heath put the body in. Thatcher buried it. And Blair read the last rites. And I think Thatcher's role in the destruction of this country is underappreciated by people due to their instinctive and justified dislike of socialism. So they, you know, she's tended to be seen as like the one good leader. That is not true. She was a modernist. She modernized, destroyed old community structures, destroyed social structures, what John Gray calls intermediary institutions, centralized the government, increased immigration, introduced a Race Relations Act in 1986, which is still on the books today, you know, promoted gender equality and many, many other things under the guise of being a conservative. In fact, what she was is a balls-out liberal, okay? And I will give Maggie the respect of saying that she did, in fact, have balls. Everybody knew that. But, you know, all in the wrong direction, basically. And I think the sooner people on our side realize that Thatcher is not like the one good prime minister, they've all been bad. Since Churchill, they've all been bad, every single one without exception. I'm going to be speaking at an event about Tony Blair. It's called something like Tony Blair Grand. It was Tony Blair the Grand Zero? Or was he like the, you know, I'm going to be arguing that you need to see Blair as a continuity of Thatcher. And many of the terrible things that Blair did were a continuation of Thatcher's legacy, which she said herself at one point. Anyway, let's get going.
Britain is a country haunted by its past. It is possessed by the memory of a golden age, a time long ago when this country was the most powerful on earth. This is a film about what happens when politicians summon up that romantic vision. For a moment, it gives them immense power. But then they discover they have invoked forces they cannot control. The price they pay is to become imprisoned by their dream. They and the British people find themselves trapped by their history.
Extremely interesting start by Curtis. Thought-provoking as ever.
The story begins in 1941, in a castle in Nazi Germany.
People saying it's a bit quiet, I cannot turn it up. So what I will have to do is turn myself down. And hopefully we'll be at the same level. Let me see if I can do that. How do I turn myself down? Hold on a minute. After I do this, if you continue to complain about audio levels, I will ban you. But there we go. Okay, so I was on 100. Now I'm on 40, so I should be at the same level as Curtis.
I belong to Kolitz, dear old Kolitz Voss. There's nothing the matter with Kolitz if someone is gone and lost.
Kolitz was Germany's most secure prisoner of war camp. No one had ever escaped. But one young captain was determined to try. His name was Airy Neave.
Neave was in fact taking part in this review in the camp theatre, so-called. And the idea was that Neave should go from under the stage into a passage which the Germans didn't know existed, and then Neave was to go down in German uniform, down through the guardroom, and march out past 1, 2, 3 gates and sentries. An ambitious programme, which they did successfully.
Neave became a hero, but he was just one of many legendary figures imprisoned in Kolditz. They included the fighter pilot, Douglas Bader, and the man who founded the SAS, Colonel David Stirling. All of them were trying to get back to the Britain they knew and loved.
Underneath the arches, I dream my dreams away. Underneath the arches, on cobblestones I lay.
Most of the people at Kolditz, this is sheer snobbery, were either regular officers or territorial officers, most of whom had been at public schools and had therefore used to coal showers and beatings and that sort of thing. And the sort of Britain that we wanted to go back to was the old-fashioned Britain, which had Union Jacks and an empire and stability and order and decency and all that sort of thing.
Good, 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 good. Perfectly understandable.
Sleeping when it's rain.
What's that on your shoulder?
What, this?
Yes.
It's a Greek urn.
What's a Greek urn?
Oh, I don't know, about 30 bob a week, I mean.
In the years after the war, Kolditz became a powerful symbol of British heroism in the face of overwhelming odds. 30 years later, those heroic values were reawakened in an unexpected way. By the early 70s, Britain had become a country torn by industrial strife. Airy Neave was an eminent backbench Tory MP. He was respected for his gallant war record and for serving as a lawyer at the Nuremberg trials. He believed the Britain he had fought for was being destroyed.
Correctly believed that the Britain he had fought for was being destroyed. Absolutely, he was correct in that assessment.
During that period, the 70s, Airy Neave undoubtedly felt, as many of us did of that generation at that time in the House of Commons, that the values which saw us through the war were slipping away, in the same sense as it was all under threat when we fought our war.
I think the thing was that we'd been through a war, and I think we could see the dangers more clearly than those who hadn't.
I think this was
the thing, really. I think this is why perhaps we were more prominent than others, trying to make people realise that these were very real dangers which existed.
Neave was not...
Two based gentlemen, based, correct.
Not alone. Many of his generation had a romantic picture of Britain. Its history was somehow different from the rest of the world. This Britain, they were convinced, had to be defended.
Well, we knew that Great Britain had led the world morally,
we had always been the moral leaders of the world, I think. And our values were the right values. And it seemed to us that the wrong values are being imposed. In other words, thuggery instead of common sense and things like that. And we wanted to combat it.
Some of the Colditz generation even set up private militias, a network of retired military officers who would take over the running of the country if law and order collapsed.
Oh, I wish they had succeeded. How amazing would that have been if these gentlemen that we're seeing here had succeeded in taking over the country and restoring order. It is a shame that they were thwarted in that effort.
I think it has to be available just as we had a Home Guard during my war. We need people there to fight or do whatever is necessary, build boats, drive cars or trains, but be available in any form of emergency.
In October 1974, Edward Heath lost the second general election of that year. Labour was now firmly in power, committed to creating a socialist Britain. Airy Neave believed that this would finally destroy the Britain he believed in. He decided to fight. The first step would be to take over the Conservative Party. It was his patriotic duty.
I think I came to this conclusion after October 1974. I went to Mr. Heath myself and explained the position to him. We'd been friends for a number of years. I said that I felt that there should be a change of leadership and that I would be associated with any election program that might take place with regard to candidates for the opposition.
He really wanted to get rid of Ted Heath as the leader. So he looked around for someone who was the opposite of Ted Heath, and he, without any great hope that it would work the first time round, picked on Margaret.
I mean, that was his first mistake. He wants to save the country, right? He wants to save the country and restore the old values. So he chooses a woman who is a staunch classical liberal, dedicated to free market fundamentalism. Those are three cardinal mistakes that he made. Sorry to be so critical. His heart was in the right place, but his decision-making was atrocious.
I've never been very good at pushing myself in matters of this kind, and just out of the blue, Airy came to me one day in the House of Commons and said, have you got anyone organising your campaign? I said, good heavens, no. Organising it? You don't push yourself. It's a matter for other people. And he said, well, I think I'd better take it over then, don't you? And I said, well, I'd be delighted. Just like that.
Now, I understand that you ran a very discreet campaign, what's been described as a kind of Colditz campaign on behalf of Mrs. Thatcher, so that Mr. Heath's camp didn't really know what had hit them until it was too late. Is that true?
I think it's entirely true. I think it was very important with a new candidate when the establishment of the Conservative Party were organising in support of the leader, which was very proper.
I would just like to say that if you're casting around for people to save the country at this time, Powell is right there. Kicked out of the party by Heath, Powell is still right there. He was up in Ulster at that point. But no, he went for a female liberal. Baffling decision. Baffling.
For them to do, that I should run a very discreet campaign among the backbenches. And we did this quietly and discreetly. It resembles Colditz in the sense that one had to be careful what one was doing.
She won it. And on the second ballot, she won it. By which time, she and Airy Neave had become great friends. But he was another kind of, not an icon figure exactly, but totally sympathetic to her political philosophy.
I suspect what he saw was something very close to, again, the values which we'd been trying to describe. Margaret Thatcher was someone who appreciated the greatness of this country and believed in it. Airy Neave felt that she held...
Well, if that is the case, why did she oversee the complete Americanization of this country, the selling off of this country to bloody McDonald's and Coca-Cola? Why does she set about dismantling this country? Either she lied, or she picked up F.A. Hayek late or something, but I just don't understand how it was, how they saw Thatcher as being this figure who was going to restore the past.
The same views of patriotism which he believed in himself. I think he saw that in her. And he was right.
For me, there is no choice. I do not intend to be the first woman prime minister of a mediocre and declining Britain. And I do intend to be its first woman prime minister.
Mrs. Thatcher took over a demoralised Tory party. The modern Britain the Conservatives had tried to build in the 50s and 60s.
Just decline in one clip. Just, you might as well put the word decline across that clip of what Thatcher just said.
...had collapsed. In its place, she offered a new vision. She too would modernise the economy and make it grow. But the wealth produced would recreate an older form of Britain. She promised to recapture a time when this country and its people were great.
I think it's essentially a matter of recapturing an imagined past. She had an ideal. The tools, the machinery to produce this were very modern economic ideas. And she simply applied them. But at the heart of the whole enterprise was this romantic idea of what Britain should be.
Well, somebody explain this to me. How, through the policies of Milton Friedman and Hayek and all these guys, are you going to restore the past? Yeah, we're going to rip up industry. We're going to, you know, decimate British manufacturing. Put a McDonald's on every corner, you know, massively import American ideology, and this is going to restore the past? Hello? Anyone? Like, how is this? Like, I just don't understand the plan. It's incoherent. Completely incoherent plan.
Our armed forces stood alone against the mightiest army the world had ever seen.
He made a political broadcast in 1978, which was called Going Backwards or Forwards. And the idea was that as a result of the way the country had been governed for the previous years, Britain had gone backwards in its achievements, whereas in its past it had gone forward. And that if we could bring the past into the future, into the present, then we could go forwards ourselves. We reversed the film so that the things that had been achievements became failures.
And because it pays people not to work, today, less and less is made in Britain. We pay our armed forces less. Instead of fighting for the country, they're fighting fires or emptying dustbins. In a word, Britain is going backwards.
And the argument was that if we could bring the glories of the past into the present and gain the economic strength that the past had had, then we had a chance of regaining the glories of the past in the present day.
Her vision was of a great Britain that had always respected authority and discipline, a hierarchical Britain, a Britain where people did what they were told, and where the benefit was that you could hold your head up in the world.
I mean, if only she was that base, though. If only these people were as based as Tony Benn just outlined. I just don't see it, though. I don't see any aspect of what Thatcher actually did bringing this about. If anything, she accelerated egalitarianism and, you know, vapid, empty, materialistic and stupid American ideology into this country.
It is a view of history. It's not by any means the only one, because it's a view of history that has only really been in the interests of a tiny minority of powerful people. Her intention was to take Britain back to roughly where it was at the beginning of the 19th century.
Mrs. Thatcher's vision of what actually constituted the glories of Britain in the 19th century came largely from one source. She was inspired by Winston Churchill and his version of British history.
Oh, fucking hell. Oh. You can see why this was dead in the water straight away, can't you? You know, we're going to look to the biggest dipshit in America, in British history. Biggest traitor in British history. The man largely responsible for the decline and fall of the British Empire. The man who sold this country out and destroyed this country for some stupid war that he was rabid, like a wolverine trying to fight. And this is the man who inspires the vision of the past. I mean, forgive me, friends, but these people are thick. They are thick as mints.
Her idea of what the past constituted was very much influenced by Churchill. So she took on, more or less, holus bolus, Churchill's view of great, as in Great Britain. And she used...
It's like saying, I'm going to improve my health by drinking poison. That's how I would describe the move that Thatcher is making here.
To play those Churchill tapes, sound tapes, quite regularly. She used to refer to him as Winston, as though he was an old friend and mate. But that's the way she thought of him, you see.
Churchill exercised a powerful, almost mesmeric hold, not just on Mrs. Thatcher, but on many of her generation who had grown up in the war. In 1940, he had captivated them with a series of radio broadcasts that gave a romantic picture of their island story.
In 1940, Churchill was able to conjure up a vision of Britain and British history and the British Empire, which was his and was completely sincere. And in a strange way, he was able to convince us all that we were indeed the inheritors of the great traditions of the past, and that it was a privilege for us to play a part.
Unfortunately, he wasn't sincere. He was a liar and a charlatan who was hoodwinking the entire nation.
However minor, in this great drama which he was creating for us.
This ordeal by fire has, in a certain sense, even exhilarated the manhood and the womanhood of Britain. All are proud of being under the fire of the enemy. This indeed is the grand heroic period of our history, and the light of glory shines on all.
This was all just bollocks to get people to fight in this stupid war. Just to get them up for the war. That's all it was.
Churchill had invoked this bright, heroic image of Britain's history to rally his people at a time when the country faced almost certain defeat. But in doing so, he led the British people into a world of his own imagining. They were drawn by the power of his imagination into an idealized vision of Britain's past, a dream of a world that was long gone.
He subordinated reason, effectively, to a heroic myth. The glory, I think, was there, but the reality behind it, the reality behind the glory of the Queen's Jubilee, of Queen Victoria's Jubilee, or Edward VII's coronation, that was irrecoverable because that was based on material and military strength where it had all been spent. He was imprisoned by...
So he basically just said the material reality of the past that Churchill was conjuring was destroyed by Churchill, to just tease out exactly what he was saying. Churchill had fucked it. So he was appealing to it to get people to fight in his war, but he had left the nation in a massively, massively worse place than it was before he came into office.
By vision, at the same time as he was inspired by it.
When he took over in 1940, Churchill was faced in cabinet by hard-headed politicians like the Foreign Secretary, Lord Halifax. Halifax and many other ministers believed Churchill to be a dangerous fantasist. He was deluding the British people into thinking they were still great. But Churchill was convinced that the only way to win the war was to inspire the people with a vision of their greatness.
It could be argued that it was a contrary. There were sophisticated people who said this is all hot air, but I tell you, the mass of the people, it was an extraordinary experience. So we entered his dream.
Look at him. Look at his stupid pig face. Willingly lying to millions of people to lead them to their death and to his own country's ultimate demise. Just wanting to look at his face for a moment. I hate him so much.
But there were parts of Britain's history that did not fit into Churchill's dream, nor into Mrs. Thatcher's. They were about to intrude violently into the heart of her world.
Chris Patton and I were working on a speech for her in the room actually overlooking the car park. It was in the opposition leader's set of rooms. And we were working away, and there was a sudden bang, and I looked up, and Chris said, I think that was a bomb. And I said, oh, I don't think so. It was probably a car backfiring. Well, it was a car, but it wasn't backfiring. Chris pulled the curtains to rapidly and said, don't go near the curtains, it is a bomb. No one knew who it was, but then they checked the registration number, and of course it turned out to be Airy. She wasn't there at the time. She'd been off opening a fete somewhere out of London.
As soon as you could, I got to ask 2 minutes here, someone being killed in a bomb accident. I'm coming to talk to you. Just now, 7 minutes ago. It's all right. But we don't know yet.
Yeah. Terrible news, Mrs.
I don't know about it yet. I'm just concerned it's just only been.
All we know is that it's one dead.
Reminiscent of that moment when the guy told George Bush about 9/11, isn't it? Kind of reminded me of that. I have to say, by the way, Curtis at this point in 1995 is already a master documentary maker. He is already leveled up significantly in the, 5-6 years we've been reviewing him here. I mean, he is already at the top of his game here in Living Dead. That sequence we just watched was brilliant.
Airy Neave had been assassinated by the newly formed Irish National Liberation Army.
Oh no.
When Mrs. Thatcher appointed Neave opposition spokesman on Northern Ireland, he had promised tough new measures if the Conservatives won the general election. The political wing of the INLA was the Irish Republican Socialist Party.
Neave would have been a person of who would have been perceived to have been a considerable threat, and would have been perceived to have been somebody of, if he had ever become Secretary of State, would have transformed the situation. A person who was saying things about the Irish people, about internment, about bringing back the death penalty for people engaged in what he called terrorist acts in Ireland.
Such a shame this guy was killed for being based, gave his life for being based.
Then, of course, he suddenly became a person of some significance in Ireland. He appeared, anyway, on the face of it, to represent that that new force in the Tory party, that kind of reactionary view of a lower middle class losing its base of support, losing its power, attempting to grasp again that element of power that it felt it should have had, that it perhaps felt it was entitled to after the Second World War, which I think perhaps Margaret Thatcher certainly represented, and perhaps manifested itself to some degree in this new heroic figure that was presented to the Irish people in the shape of Éireann Éave.
Your people remember him for a lot of things, perhaps most of all for the fact that he got out of coal bits. They don't remember him so much for the many kindnesses he did. Really a person, a wonderful person, of tremendous inner strength. And just one more thing. Some devils got him. And they must never, never, never be allowed to triumph. They must never prevail. Those of us who believe in the things that Airy fought for must see that our views are the ones which continue to live on in this country.
Airy Neave.
F's in the chat. Blackpilling.
Neave was buried at Abinger in Berkshire, in the heart of the English countryside. 6 weeks later, Mrs. Thatcher won the general election, and the following week a memorial service was held for Airy Neave. In her address, Mrs. Thatcher promised to rebuild the Britain he had fought for in the war.
And it was quite extraordinary. Here was this rather frail-looking, pale-looking young woman who had become Prime Minister and had become a successor to all these people, and who went up into the pulpit and made this address. It was a very extraordinary occasion, because it... I felt at the time, well, there are so many things that this country has always been good at which have fallen away, and we no longer occupy the kind of position in the world that warrants them being said.
Yeah, if you missed it, he got killed by Irish nationalists.
But this, the way she did it, somehow I thought, we still do that kind of thing better than any other country. And it was very moving. And this was right at the beginning of her premiership.
The night of the victory of 79, she was entirely emotional. She had found her moment. She had this very powerful and very romantic, in the strict sense of the word, view of what her country had been and how she was going to remake it.
And so you think a penny off here means a penny off there? Just enlarge your ideas of what this country can do.
One of Mrs. Thatcher's aims was to generate a new sense of pride in Britain's past. For over 30 years, monuments to the country's greatness had lain discarded. They had been replaced by modern sculpture. Now that was all to change. Her supporters took up the challenge.
One evening I was standing on one of the gates just over there, and I wondered why we have a spotlight on King George V when a man, I think, of national importance down in the square should have the same treatment, Sir Winston Churchill. Bearing in mind he was the right man, the right place at the right time, and I thought, well, this is definitely not on.
Hello?
And the next thing I know, I've got a letter in my tray saying, you know, well done, I think your idea is brilliant and all this business, or words to that effect. And, hey presto, the light appeared.
This episode's blackpilling me, friends. It's blackpilling me.
Due to you? Well, yes, I think it was definitely. Well, it was. There's no question about it.
Sir Winston Churchill had 13 models made in his lifetime. Are you anticipating to have lots more sittings for new models?
Well, I hope so. This is number two. It's better than number one.
Mrs. Thatcher quickly established herself as a new kind of leader, driven by a messianic vision. But her party didn't realise the price the country would have to pay to be reborn in her terms. By 1981, the inner cities were torn by riots. Unemployment was nearing 3 million. Those at the top of the Conservative Party were convinced that Mrs. Thatcher's policies risked destroying both their party and the country.
Well, the country was in massive economic decline. Huge interest rates, huge inflation rate, massive unemployment rising all the time. Pay rises out of control. The unions still very strong and causing strikes all over the place, making massively unreasonable demands. She'd done 2 years. She was visited by the men in grey suits who said, well, this was a jolly nice experiment and you were, after all, the first woman prime minister, but it's not really worked, has it? Why don't you clear off? And she became very isolated for the first time.
What she thought in 1981 was that if she lost the battle of the budget that year, all her dreams, all her hopes would have failed. So she stuck to it. And I remember her at the time, again and again, repeating, almost like a mantra, Churchill in 1940, Churchill in 1940, Churchill in 1940.
The moment in 1940 to which Mrs. Thatcher looked for inspiration was a meeting at which Churchill defeated his critics in Cabinet. It happened at the end of May. The German armies were pushing the British back towards Dunkirk. Halifax and other ministers wanted to make a deal with Hitler, but Churchill was determined to fight on. He called a meeting of the whole government, including the junior ministers.
I reckon Curtis is secretly our guy, even if he doesn't know it.
He made a sweeping, romantic speech. Any idea of negotiation now seemed unworthy of the destiny of a great nation.
And he gave them a terrific tirade, and using all the emotive language that in Cabinet just made people look away in embarrassment, and about how we will fight till we choke on our own blood and things like that. These are the records of this meeting are about. Minting a few phrases, minting many phrases, which he was later to use to great effect in public. And he got a unanimous standing ovation support from them.
Methinks I see in my mind a mighty and puissant nation rousing herself like a strong man after sleep and shaking her invincible locks. Methinks I see her as an eagle, mewing her mighty youth, kindling her undazzled eyes at the full midday beam, purging and unscaling her long-abused sight at the fountain itself of heavenly radiance.
And the irony is that Churchill delivered the breathing space. He delivered the victories. But because he'd done it by invoking this a special myth that gave a kind of impregnability to the ideas, and no one could question them, he and we were still lumbered with this myth, which is the very romantic vision of our past and how it had to be projected into our future. Still today, it is a treason to question these arguments. I don't want to listen to the arguments. The myth is what counts.
In July 1981, Mrs. Thatcher called a full cabinet meeting. Against opposition from most of her ministers, she insisted they pursue the new economic policies. If they didn't, the glorious Britain she had promised to create would be lost forever.
She knew that she did not have the full trust of the cabinet, but she fought it through nonetheless. And she invented a consensus of the nation, the junior ministers, the backbenchers, all of whom she thought shared her vision of what England had been and could be. All this was inspired by her childhood reading of Churchill.
she was in a dream world.
Mrs. Thatcher had overwhelmed her opponents by summoning up a romantic vision of the past. But such was the power of her dream that she also raised other ghosts, the ghosts of Ireland's history, which was inextricably linked with that of Britain.
We found, in the Republican movement, we found it was much easier to oppose and to fight Mrs. Thatcher than it was with Ted Heath or indeed Harold Wilson and so on, because Mrs. Thatcher appeared the personification of all that had gone before, of English tyranny, as it was in Ireland.
Say hello to the provost.
Lloyd George and Churchill sent the black and tans to Ireland. And this was Churchill back again, and that he was no friend of Ireland or of the Irish people. She seemed to bring up all that type of thing again.
Yeah, because Churchill was just an unremitting prick in all ways. That's why he did nothing good in his entire career.
She must have known what she was doing. Or did she?
In March 1981, Republican prisoners began a hunger strike in support of their claim for political status. Mrs. Thatcher refused any concessions. The resulting conflict brought two powerful versions of British history into direct opposition.
History played an enormously important motivating role, I think, for the people who went on the hunger strike. And they, I think, individually found themselves in the situation of actually carrying, just by pure chance, just because of the historical circumstances, the special circumstances, of having to carry the weight of that history and to honour it, that somehow the current of history passed through them. And I think they would have, all of them, individually felt that, and that's why they made the decision.
People are asking about Churchill's taste in cigars. This is one area where he is quite unimpeachable, and in the cigar world, he is correctly considered a legend and has the Romeo and Julietta Churchill named after him, as well as the H. Upman Sir Winston, and a whole line in the Davidoff brand as well. The size of cigar is called a Churchill. That's how big he is in the cigar world. So that is one area, but we can give him that, you know. But that is, you know, if he'd stuck to smoking cigars and didn't get involved in politics, I'd like him a lot more.
Sands, Bobby, anti-H block, Armour, political prisoner, 30,000.
Yeah! Bobby Sands, the hunger strikers' leader, was elected to Westminster on a wave of public sympathy. It was the beginning of Sinn Féin as a modern political party. 4 weeks later, Bobby Sands died. But Mrs. Thatcher refused to negotiate. After 9 more deaths, the strike was called off. Mrs. Thatcher had won. But she paid a price for her victory. The powerful historical forces she had summoned up in Ireland were not under her control.
And suddenly, she was confronted by people that she didn't think very much of, that she didn't consider very important or very significant, that didn't figure at all in her understanding of the priorities facing her at any particular moment in time. And suddenly, she's confronted by history, if you like, a very real history, one represented by the Irish perception of history.
Mrs. Thatcher, if you like, in stage managing all this kind of thing, actually played into the hands of the Republican movement at the time. She disturbed some very unquiet ghosts.
Suddenly, in 1982, the ghosts of Britain's grand imperial past returned. On April the 2nd, Argentina invaded the Falklands. Within hours, the British chiefs of staff came to Number 10. They proposed that Mrs. Thatcher send a fleet of ships and men to recapture the islands.
In fact, it was Sir Henry Leach, I think, who was the first Lord of the Admiralty, who said to her, "Well, Prime Minister, I can only tell you, if you don't do it, this country will never be quite the same country again." And that went right like an arrow through her.
But she sent the task force, she got the task force together, and she sent it that day. It was a marvellous moment for her, and she did it in a truly Churchillian manner. And she took the tie, just as Churchill did, against all the play-safe people in the cabinet, people who'd been conditioned in the whole ethic of appeasement and compromise and didn't think we were strong enough to do it. And they were just outnumbered. The flow of public feeling rushed over them because she invoked it immediately.
As the fleet sailed out from Portsmouth, the warships passed over divers working to recover the wreck of the Mary Rose. Henry VIII's great wooden flagship had sunk in a battle with the French over 400 years before. The recovery teams were based in the naval dockyards.
When we were going out to the site from the naval base, we go past the hot walls, the defensive gun battery that controls the entrance to the harbour. And there were the wives and the mothers waving the ships goodbye. It was terribly emotional, terribly, terribly, terribly highly strung. I thought I'd never see such a thing in England again. I was incredibly surprised that I felt so emotional and so passionately in support of the people who were going, because it seemed we were almost fighting an old-fashioned war, to me personally. But I was probably terribly wrong in that judgment, but it seemed to me it was an old-fashioned war. We were back with the invasion force, which was my last memory of war, my last personal memory.
I think the Falklands was something which Mr. Galtieri, he needed a good smack in the teeth, as I think at least think we were going to sit around scratching ourselves. We had our national pride to think of, and I think this is where Margaret Thatcher came into her own in making a decision to go there and teach him a lesson he wasn't going to forget.
I'm not actually against any of this stuff, by the way, which I've been a bit quiet. I'm actually for this action that Thatcher took here and the feelings that it inspired. Actually a good bit of politics, and generally positive, I would say. You know, even if Churchill was the inspiration for it.
To inform Her Majesty that the White Ensign flies alongside the Union Jack in South Georgia. God save the Queen.
What happens next?
What's it not? Thank you very much.
Just your reaction, rejoice at that news and congratulate our forces and the Marines.
Probably her most based moment, to be honest.
She whipped round and said, "Rejoice, rejoice!" You know, like an absolute, like a tornado sweeping in, and then practically, you know, I could see them start back. It was extraordinary. She had this power then. She could see herself as Churchill.
On the 14th of June, a ceasefire was announced on the Falklands. The Argentine troops surrendered to the British.
Hello and welcome to Southsea Castle for what promises to be the most remarkable archaeological event that we in this country are ever likely to see. The raising and homecoming of the Tudor warship, the Mary Rose.
At the time of the recovery, in the public eye, there was a close association And the two things, the Falklands returning of a fleet, the successful return of the task force, and the recovery of the Mary Rose, were inescapably interwoven. What we were bringing back, I think, was the intense feeling that we're an island, and we've defended an island for centuries.
There is the wreck of the Mary Rose. It has come to the surface. There is the first sight of this flagship of Henry VIII. It's the first time we have seen this in 437 years.
A wonderful moment. You hear all the sirens ringing, and I should think probably the Navy will get in on the act. It has.
All this stuff is good, by the way. I'm not going to be critical of it. All this is good.
I have no regrets. We had to send that task force. We had to regain those islands for our people. Regrets is a chapter of pride for our country.
In November 1982, a victory parade was held in the city of London. Mrs. Thatcher and the chiefs of staff took the salute. None of the royal family was present.
A lot of the British people then realised that we could hold our heads up again and that we could be strong in the world. I mean, it was an extraordinary achievement, this flotilla going across the world, taking 6 weeks to get there and then boffing them and coming back again. I mean, I think that's a British-type achievement.
Is it very, very heavy?
No, it's not heavy. This is all in porcelain. The quality of the work is superb. Look above all at the expression on the faces of the Marines. It is the spirit of Britain, and it is everything that makes us great.
She brought back, I think, something which a lot of people thought that they'd never see again. She was giving the country back their pride. Great back in the Great Britain. Our history is special in as much that everyone's tried to give us a good of hiding since the year dot. The Romans failed, I think, really miserably. They didn't really succeed in conquering the whole of England.
All of this spirit that you're seeing here has been destroyed, which should be brought back in spades. Thatcher did a good thing with this.
We, the British people, are proud of what has been done. Proud of these heroic pages in our island story. Proud to be here today to salute the task force. Proud to be British.
She was on a high after the Falklands, of course, and capitalised on it to great effect. Later, just as Churchill did, she was to some extent entrapped by it. And that is always the danger that of politicians who drink from this potion. It's very difficult to know when to stop. It is intoxicating mixture, and the usual consequence of intoxication is that you want more of the same.
In May 1983, Mrs. Thatcher called a general election. Every morning, the journalists were played martial music to emphasize the theme of the campaign.
Based.
A new kind of Britain had been forged in the South Atlantic. One capable of rallying to the flag with confidence and moral righteousness. She had been correct to take Britain down the road to the past.
Oh, back then? Oh, I think we thought it would never stop. I think we thought that those of us who were very close to her thought that she had done something that would go on, and that we would prosper, and we'd have low taxes, and we'd have low inflation, and we would hold our heads high, and we'd be a dominant force in the world. We would dominate a free market Europe. We would maintain the old traditional alliance with the Americans. We would establish proper links with the Commonwealth, and that we would have a joyous and economic, prosperous and dominant future. We'd brought back
the things that had made Britain great in the past. I really did, I think we really believed that. We really thought this was here to stay.
See, all this stuff was good. The trouble is the other half of the ledger, the other half of the vision, where that led to ultimately the corrosive acid of free market liberalism destroyed all of this. Let in the forces that destroyed it.
Can we ask you what you think of Mrs. Thatcher?
Marvellous! Best man in England.
The only leader that can bring us back to normality in this country.
We need a firm, a determined leader like Mrs. Thatcher to take our country back to an era where we all, you and I, we held our heads high as British.
In our time, I don't.
That guy would be on Lotus Eaters today, wouldn't he?
I don't know whether Carol would agree with this. There have been two great prime ministers and only two, Winston Churchill and Margaret Thatcher.
Yes, this is I would absolutely go along with that. Because she did things against the advice of everyone.
The thing is, we all love a Sikh. They've always been the based ones, haven't they, the Sikhs?
For a period, a certain ascendancy was established over people, and history played a part in winning that ascendancy for her, because people felt it was inevitable, it was natural, it was normal, this is what life was about, this is what we've all been waiting for, this would deal with the unruly mob, would cause such a lot of trouble. I think that's really what she was doing.
She reconstructed from Churchill, or from her understanding of Churchill.
I should mention the last time I saw a Sikh was a taxi driver who took me from Heathrow Airport back home. And he must have given one of the most extraordinary reactionary rants I've ever heard. It was, I was kind of holding my tongue not to try to egg him on too much, because he was an extraordinary, taxi drivers are often like that, but that was a memorable journey.
The whole sense of a separate British identity that was not collectivist but individualist. And this is what she thought he believed in. Not wholly inaccurately, but perhaps a little fancifully. And that's what we, you and I, live with now.
See, this is the error. They're getting on the error here of the individualism, the liberalism, the bullshit that she believed in are ultimately the things. I mean, it's so ironic, isn't it? And tragic. Is ultimately, I mean, the Falkland stuff and that kind of spirit of nationhood and the history, these things are good to draw on. But ultimately, that's a collectivist spirit. And, as we're seeing here, she believed in this idea of kind of, you know, rugged, almost Ayn Randian individualism, which is a dissolving acid for any nation.
We're living in her version of Churchill's version of British history.
But it's a dream.
Of course. All dreams are in some sense, remember your Freud, reality.
What we have today, in fact, all week, we have a...
The Sikhs get so much love because they were loyal to the empire, fierce soldiers, generally, you know, supported rather than agitated against British power. That's why they get so much love from the British.
Saxon travelling village set in the 9th century, and people can wander around and they can have a look at spinning and they can have a look at soldiers guarding the camp and skills at arms, and they can see various activities that would have taken place in the 9th century, which frankly you just don't see anymore.
In 1984, Mrs. Thatcher set up English Heritage. One of its aims was to bring the past to life. It organised historical reenactments of great moments from British history.
We don't actually do many Second World War events,
because it's a bit close to home. There's still people who lost loved ones in the Second World War, and frankly, we think it's a little bit tasteless to run around shooting each other on a battlefield, make-believe, if you like, when it really happened.
This is also a good thing that she did. Fully support this. Excellent initiative, Maggie.
It is a matter of taste, really, and we believe that history at a safe historical distance is rather better than something which can still cause personal pain to people.
In the mid-80s, an intense mood of nostalgia swept Britain. Whole new towns were built, faithfully reproducing the world of 100 years before.
Excellent, brilliant, fantastic initiatives, fully support. These places still exist. I like to visit them. Brilliant. Great. I'll praise things when they're good, and this is all good.
They were constructed on land left empty by the industrial closures of the past 5 years. Those who had once worked in the factories and the mines found themselves acting out the lives of their ancestors.
Awesome.
In 1974, there had been 800 museums. Now there were 2,000. Mrs. Thatcher instructed the architect Quinlan Terry to reconstruct the interior of Downing Street as an exact copy of how it had been in the 18th century.
Based. All these are excellent things that Thatcher did. This side of Thatcher is good. It's the liberal side of Thatcher that is bad.
She lived above this perfectly restored world in the attic.
It is a homely room, actually. It's a homely flat. You know, it's not a grand flat. As you can see, we're up in the attic. This is where the staff used to live many, many years ago. But we love it. Yes, we do feel at home here. Well, at weekends, it's just terribly quiet.
No vision of history is wholly real. What Churchill liked to do was select from history as he'd read it, the glorious moments. The same is true of Margaret Thatcher, in that her vision of the past was very imaginative. Any politician who tries to use history almost invariably doesn't get it quite right. But what drives them on is what bits they select.
I am completely fine with this, by the way. And maybe soon I will do a cigar stream on George Sorel's. What's that book called? What's that book by Sorel called? George Sorel, Reflections on Violence, where he talks about the uses of myth and the importance of myth. I'm completely fine with all of this. You know, even if that myth is not quite accurate or is rose-tinted or whatever, this is good in producing a moral unity between the elites and the people. You know, which is ultimately what any society and what any nation or empire needs. So yeah, I'm completely fine with this whole concept and idea. I am not fine with that sinister prick, though. I am not fine with Churchill.
For 6 hours this morning, southern Britain was battered by the worst storms the nation has known for nearly three centuries. They came in from the ocean without any warning from the weathermen. The winds were those of a hurricane.
I heard a type of whistling noise, a very eerie noise, and the sky was incredible colours, although it was the middle of the night. It wasn't black, it was kind of orange glow. And at first light, I opened my front door and the forest had just completely gone. and there was a horizon where one hadn't been for about 300 years. The gardens of the historic houses, and we're surrounded by them in this area. All of them were absolutely devastated, and it was as if the whole of the past of English history had been wiped away in just a few hours.
Then, 4 days later, an event occurred that challenged the very foundations of Mrs. Thatcher's vision of a new Great Britain.
Monday turned out to be a watershed. We came in not really knowing what to expect after the hurricane and everything else, and we simply stared at the screens all day, watching the Sea of Red, as it was known, watching financial prices falling. And realizing that the British people had simply lost control over their economy.
In the 80s, Mrs. Thatcher had freed the financial markets from any controls.
Stupid.
Her aim was to...
Completely stupid, counterintuitive, and undermines all of the great things that she did in the rest of this documentary.
Transform the city into the powerhouse of the New Britain. But the effect was to help create a global system of currency dealing in which national boundaries became irrelevant. When the markets panicked, as they did on Black Monday, there was nothing the government could do to stop them. Mrs. Thatcher had lost control of her country's destiny.
The significance of Black Monday was quite simply that we had all been led to believe that Mrs. Thatcher was in control of events. A lot of us suspected that perhaps that was an exaggeration. It was clear that she was trying to cover up a lot of the cracks with a lot of rhetoric. We had to accept the logic of the market, which was quite simply that there was no longer any entity which we could reasonably and realistically call the Great British Economy.
Do you think she knew that?
I suspect that towards the end, with the kind of problems which emerged at the end, she began to suspect that perhaps she had been chasing an illusion, yes.
I mean, if you surrender your country to the global market, of course it will be, its destiny will be steered by the global market. I mean, this is one of the things that I haven't really talked about that much, but I have come to see what people call socialism, government controls, as the predominance of force over economy. And it is completely unavoidable if you want things in your nation to be fixed. Okay? Market is flux. Force is fixed. And you cannot have a society, you cannot have a nation, if all things are in flux. You have to keep certain things fixed with controls. Otherwise, you don't have a society. And I truly believe this. And I say that with a completely full understanding of Austrian economics as well. That is my current thinking. It has been for quite a long time now. Don't call me a socialist or whatever. This is just a fact of reality. No matter what you call it, in any era, you need certain things that are held down in place. Otherwise, this sort of thing happens.
Towards the end of the Second World War, Churchill came to realise that the reality behind his dream of a great imperial Britain was fading. The price the country had paid for standing alone against Hitler was to bankrupt itself. He had invoked a dream only to see the last remnants of it destroyed.
Churchill was beginning to fade a little. I know that he was very conscious that he no longer wielded the real power. That was being wielded by the United States. They had overtaken us. When they first came into the war, we were the predominant power, even from a military point of view.
What a wanker, Churchill. I don't want to be tiresome, friends, but I really cannot emphasize the damage this man did to this country. Could it have been stopped? could the rise of the Americans have been stopped? No, but Britain could have made very different decisions and not destroyed itself and its empire. And it could have remained as a bulwark against American power in the world had this dipshit not taken all the decisions that he did. Sold the nation down the river. For what? Why did he do that? For a couple of book tours around a few American universities and a lifetime supply of whiskey. Twat.
Roosevelt wanted to bring the British Empire to an end. They made no bones about it.
The Americans believed that Churchill's underlying aim in the war was to recapture Britain's lost imperial glory. It was a plan to restore the world the Prime Minister loved the most, the 19th century world of unabashed great power politics. The Americans would have none of it. Increasingly, they excluded Churchill from discussions on the shape of the post-war world.
This is, by the way, the first time, and this will become a recurring feature as we go forward with Curtis, assuming that this makes the 7,800, of Curtis summarizing his previous work. This is Oceans Apart, or several episodes of Oceans Apart, in like a little 5-minute summary. And he will do this. I know for a fact that he revisits Living Dead in Century of the Self later on. And this is an interesting thing because he builds up a layer of self-references back to his old work. So this is the first time we're really seeing it. This is Oceans. This is a bit of Oceans Apart, basically, inserted in here.
Britain's power was over.
I suppose very reluctantly and very privately, he realised that we no longer disposed of the strength, even on the scale with which we disposed of it when the war started. It was a pretty bleak prospect for him. The appearance of glory was all there. You know, the sitting in the chairs and the cavalcade and the saluting sentries and so on. That was magnificent. But underneath it, the whole thing had been washed away.
Around that time, there was a sort of private lunch that I was invited to down at Chequers. It was the most beautiful day, rather like today. Birds singing in the trees, and this was an English garden, if ever there was one. And really, the idea that you could feel that anything was wrong, or whatever would be wrong, was alien to the atmosphere of that particular afternoon. I suddenly saw her sitting on a sofa quite apart from everybody else, looking again with a sort of strange look, as if she was sort of peering into the distance, into the future, and seeing something that was not attractive to her.
Security was very, very tight at that time. The IRA had become even more serious threats, and so she was constantly protected from mixing with ordinary people the way she used to. Downing Street had become a bunker. The fight with the cabinet was intense. You'd had these big resignations by Lawson and Howe and so on. The problem is that the effect of the poll tax was to make people, ordinary folk, appear to be the enemy. The very people whose nerves she'd touched and who had voted her into power.
In 1990, Mrs. Thatcher was finally forced to resign as Prime Minister. A majority within the Conservative Party had decided that her time was past. Her policies were tearing the party and Great Britain apart.
I think that Margaret Thatcher's best speech was on the last knockings of her reign as Premier in the House when she said, "To hell with all this, you're going to get both barrels." And it was a lovely sight to see. And that's when I realised that I was seeing a Rolls-Royce leave the scene of politics and maybe would never see the likes of it again in my lifetime. So, there we are.
I'm enjoying this! The White House Security doesn't even know what it means or how to mention something!
She
seemed to me, at the time, almost like a Greek tragedy. But here was a woman who, for a brief time, had held the world in her hands, or at least held this country's world in her hands, and she felt that it was all slipping away.
The dream continued virtually to the end, and in my opinion...
What is that film he's using with Churchill and this woman? Kind of fascinated by what that is. Does anybody know? That looks like a very interesting document, whatever that film is.
It was when she lost contact with the dream that she lost contact with reality.
I know where I've seen him. A picture. There's a picture of him. A miniature in a cracked glass in the attic. I'll show you.
It can't be.
It can't be. You know him. But you said...
Yes, miss, you see, he's dead.
Underneath the armchair, I dream my dreams away. Underneath the armchair, on cobblestones I lay.
My
wife's gone to the West Indies.
Your wife's gone to the West Indies.
That's right.
Jamaica?
No, she went of her own accord.
Now it's time for a new chapter to open. And I wish John Major all the luck in the world. He'll be splendidly served. And he has the makings of a great prime minister.
As the war drew to a close, Churchill came to realise that the power his romantic vision of history gave him was gone. One night in despair, he said to his doctor, "I want to sleep for a billion years. Stupendous issues are unfolding before our eyes. Yet we are only specks of dust that have settled in the night on the map of the world."
The myth which and the vision which Churchill invoked is, it's centuries old, but it's there all right. It's there all right, and politicians can, they're very nervous of it. They're like people who don't want to, like alcoholics who don't want to open a bottle, and because they'll change, and they become captivated by it, just as so many who have drawn on it too deeply, or drunk from it too deeply, do get disoriented and derationalized.
Land of hope and glory, mother of the free.
Land of hope and glory, mother of the free. How can we extol thee? Who are born of thee? Brighter yet and brighter shall thy bounds be set. God that made thee mighty, make thee mightier yet. God that made thee mighty, repetition this, make thee mightier yet. I think that's it. But how shall we, that's the thing as heaven made, except how shall we extol thee?
What does it make you feel when you hear that sort of music?
Oh, it always gives me a good feeling, yes.
Wow, that was brilliant. Poignant. One of his better ones, I would say. Very, very, very good. Let us hit the super chats then. Coney says, why have you become a Cummings stan? I haven't become a Dominic Cummings stan. What I did was, is I highlighted the video that he put on Twitter and said, why can't he be our guy? Because I think that he would be a tremendous asset if he was on our side of things. He's not. But I think that, you know, if I could work with Cummings, I reckon I could achieve amazing things with him. Give me Dominic Cummings and a good marketing team. Oh, possibilities are endless. Spasticus Autisticus says, I have exactly 12 and a half hours to write 5,000 words on convoluted 20th century analytical jurisprudence. I have written 274. Send me your energy, chat. I need some me magic. Chadelet and praise Keck, etc. Well, send Spasticus Autisticus all of your positive energy. You'll do it, even if you take until 5 a.m. with 10 cups of black coffee. Been there many times myself. Zolt 39 says, if you do a show on propaganda or practical politics, you could invite on Lucien Valson of Freedom Alternative. Maybe his content will interest you. Okay, I'll consider it. Coney says, imagine how based 2017-2019 AA would have been if 1995 AA had watched these Adam Curtis documentaries instead of thinking about his geography teacher's knickers. yeah, well, you know. I can't remember her name, actually. She used to just sit on the desk, cross her legs, uncross her legs, and we'd all just be there with open mouths, you know. Spasticus Autisticus says, hey, Spasticus, you should be writing your essay, mate. I had a Sikh chemistry teacher in school around the 2019 election. He went on a rant about how he had to vote UKIP because there was no BNP candidate. Based chemistry teacher. George Adams says, it is obvious that Maggie had the potential to be great for us. Was she corrupted by those across the pond? And no, I think she was corrupted basically by liberal economics and the basically made up history that Winston Churchill had, saying that the nation was built on individualism and, you know, liberal economics and all that sort of stuff. I mean, there's some truth to that, but a lot of it is made up as well, as we saw in this documentary. So I think that is the big problem. Then at the same time, America was going through its kind of Ronald Reagan, Milton Friedman moment as well. And of course, any British prime minister has to cozy up to America. That's just the geopolitical reality. I mean, they don't have to, but that was what she chose to do, as we saw in Oceans Apart. So, yeah, but she did have the potential. I mean, we saw in this documentary that her heart was in the right place when it came to the history and invoking those things. And you saw the power of it in the Falklands part of the documentary. The trouble is that those two things, you know, that kind of hierarchical, more reactionary world that the chap was describing at the start, and liberalism are basically incompatible. They're not compatible. You have to enforce those things top down. And she did some things, but she didn't do them all. And the big mistake, I think, is those financial controls, you know, complete laissez-faire. I mean, it wasn't complete laissez-faire. Incidentally, a lot of the privatization wasn't done, but in the financial sector, you know, the global markets, you know, made the nation vulnerable. And also allowing foreign companies to buy assets in the country is another major error that was made. Tim Cornish says, £499.99. Are you kidding? What? That's the biggest super chat of all time. That's got to be the biggest super chat I've ever seen. Did you make a spelling error there? I mean, I know you're a long-time supporter. I mean, that is amazing. £500 or $500. quite phenomenal. He said, this is for the Adam Curtis streams. Keep going. It's amazing. And I grew up in some of these times and seemingly knew very little until now. I mean, they have been actually better than I thought they would be. Every single one has been brilliant. This one I found very poignant and even a little bit of emotion from me, which is rare. But anyway, thank you very much. And if you didn't mean to send that much money, send me a note and I'll send it back to you. But thank you so much. Belfarus Knight says, Thatcher was born in 1925 and was a silent gen, while Churchill was lost gen. Silent reinforces whatever the lost gen and the greatest gen did. It is fascinating, but I don't know British intergenerational interaction much. I mean, isn't Joe Biden silent gen? That's a very, very wide period. Somebody born in 1925 and somebody born in 1945, that's a very wide span. And it seems bigger than between, I don't know, 1995 and now, because it's such a, so many things happened in that period. But that's a very, very interesting. Glow in the Dark says, you got to feel a little sorry for her. She had to deal with the fallout of World War II leaders' choices. It wasn't an envious position, but she was the last straw. The trouble is that she didn't come into the country. The country was already basically on its knees when she came in, and she thought the solution to all of the unionism and the post-war consensus was basically to take a sledgehammer to it and open it up to the markets. There may have been another way of doing it. I don't know how you would have done it. If I knew the answer to that question, I'd probably be a millionaire. Von here says, those Mr. Krabs IRA songs do go pretty hard. And Brian Ellis says, do a show on the occult underpinnings of fascism and Nazism, with particular regard to Evola and his book, The Complete Introduction to Magic. I'm not sure if I will do that show. My understanding is that the occultist elements and the influence of Evola on all of that is somewhat overstated. People who know more about this than me can correct me if I am wrong. But my understanding is that the playing up of the occultist element in the mid-century Germans was actually a narrative that was propagated by the church. And especially the Catholic Church, as a means of distancing themselves from what had happened after the war. So I do think it is overplayed as a narrative for that reason. So there we go. I do know Himmler kind of dabbled in that sort of stuff, and it was Himmler who invited Evola to give a series of talks in Germany, but it's very, very overstated. That's my understanding of it. And I think, unless I'm mistaken, that is it. Unless I've missed a few on entropy, I think that is everything. All right. Well, thank you very much, everybody. I'll be back on Monday for Cigar Stream. Don't know what I'm going to be talking about yet, but I might. What was the book I mentioned? I might do something on George Sorrell's book on violence and myth. I think George Sorrell is somebody I've never done a stream on, so maybe I'll do that. if you're staying up late, I know that my appearance on Jay Burden's channel will air at 1 a.m. tonight. So if you're going to stay up late, you can catch my appearance on Burden. I'll stick it in notes. And have a good rest of the week, everybody. Thank you very much. Now get out.
What goes on in this town is none of your business.
As long as I'm living here, it is.
Then maybe you shouldn't be living here!
Well, that's easily fixed.